Interesting. Very interesting. Oh!
We might be the chihuahua.
You are an ostrich.
Eggs. Dilly din, dilly dong. Come on.
Reggie, welcome.
Dilly.
Episode number 6, dilly ding, dilly
numero,
dong.
Numero. What's 6 in?
Hexagon.
Numero hexagon.
What's 6? You need to start getting your languages right, mate. Mm. Very special one today. Something a little bit different to our sports people or sports commentator that we've had on.
Very different, yeah.
Nasir Sabani is his name, better known as the Streets Barber on Instagram and around the traps. He's a very, very interesting individual. I think this one will hit a few notes for a few people.
Yeah, it's pretty intense, his story. He's had some serious problems in his own life with addiction. He's turned it around. Spends pretty much all his time now helping people that have either been in similar situations or just going through a tough time. It's full on. And I'm sure a lot of people, even if they can't relate specifically with the details, will be able to relate to the adversity side of things. So interesting guy, hell of a person.
You made fun of me a little bit in it, Reg, about I used altruistic a lot,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But in all seriousness,
perfectly sums him up.
Yeah, it does sum him up. He's there for everyone else. He's not there for himself anymore. And I think you'll find that in the podcast. It's an amazing story. He's an amazing individual with what he's doing and what he's trying to do. And I think you will really enjoy it. We actually don't say much in it, though.
We don't talk a whole lot. I will say, more than ever, I am curious for feedback on this particular podcast because it is quite heavy and he's doing incredible things. But I would love for people to let us know if this strikes any chords with them because it's an intense story.
Please enjoy the Streets Barber, Nasir Sabani.
Welcome, welcome, Hendo.
Welcome, Reg.
We got the Street Barber.
Hello, hello.
Yes, it's a very special one today.
Yeah, thanks for doing this.
Hey, guys.
We know you're a hectic man.
Nah, not at all,
So just for everyone out there, Nasir Sabani.
Yeah.
Say it the right way.
Absolutely. Actually, I'm impressed, man. Like, you said it pretty damn well.
Thank you. The Streets Barber.
You get some different...
Oh, bro, Nasir, Nasir, Nazir.
Yeah.
But you said it like to my grandma. Thank you know what I mean? So I love that.
Awesome. Good start.
Yeah.
Good start.
Yeah,
good start. Good. It's already better than most of the ones we've done.
No,
bit of white off the shoulders there.
That song was a good start, though. Oh, my God. Yeah, it's got me on a buzz.
It's a bit happy. Yeah. It's kind of a happy, lighthearted song.
I'll have to give Reg most of the credit there. He did find that one. So.
Excellent.
I can't remember how I found it. Stumbled across it.
It's kind of got like an old school, but like borderline trap kind of beat.
It is. It's trap music. Yeah, it is.
It's a very interesting
trap remix.
Trap remix. There we go.
Your stuff.
Classic.
Not your stuff.
Thank you very much.
How are you?
Awesome, man. Yeah. How are you guys?
Very good. We're excited about this one.
Hey, likewise, man.
Very excited just to hear everything about what you're doing, what you've done, what you've been through.
Cool.
And everything in between, to be honest.
So yeah.
It's an amazing story. And I'm going to let Reg just give a little bit of a background.
Bless.
No. We'll let you tell your story, but we met briefly, I'm not sure, last year sometime. A mutual friend was giving me a trim and very brief encounter, but was immediately impressed by you. And the more I got to know, we were actually talking about potential guests. And I was saying, if he agrees to do this, it's one of the most incredible stories. Now, it is, and you'll giggle because you're far too humble, but it is pretty remarkable what you've done.
Thanks, bro.
And the positivity you have. But tell us a bit about yourself. Where are you from?
Yeah, cool. All right. Well, ethnically, I'm Persian. I've never been there, though. I was born and raised in Japan. And then when I was about 6, we moved to Hawaii, settled in Hawaii for a few months, and then moved and settled in Vancouver, Canada. So I would say I was born in Japan, but more so raised in Canada. I traveled throughout North America, hence the accent. It's kind of like wishy-washy. You can't tell if I'm American or Canadian. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's like an Irish-Aussie rank sort of mongrel blend.
I wonder who that is, man.
Yeah.
Vancouver was my place. And then about 7 years ago, I moved out to Melbourne on a one-way ticket. And 18 months ago, just shy of 2 years, actually, I'm here in Geelong. Now we're talking to you boys at the shop. So it's cool.
Yeah, dope. Did you play any sport or anything growing up?
Man, I was a basketball fiend, dude. Like, that was my
really?
Thing. Yeah, absolutely. And, like, dude, it was like, you know when they say ball is life, all those memes? That was me.
That was you?
Yeah, 100%.
Were you any good?
Fucking no thanks, bro. Man, like, I'm telling you, you can't not be good.
What position?
But that's the thing. I was like Magic Johnson, bro. I played all five. Okay. You know what I mean?
Say I'm not good and then call yourself Magic Johnson.
I was like, okay, so I'm the youngest of three boys. And yeah, man, I was just getting stepped on left, right, and center as a kid. And then like I just went through my growth spurt. I was about 15, 16, late bloomer. But I grew, man. And I remember my brother had just come back from one of his missions overseas or wherever he was, you know, volunteering at the time. And we were playing pickup, and he used to just embarrass the crap out of me as a kid. And then this was like such an impactful day. Like, we played one-on-one, and I beat him like 11-2, 11-1. And then last game was like 11-0. And on the last point, I just threw it down and dunked over my oldest brother. And that was like such a mind-shaking moment for him and I both. So unfortunately, I think with the introduction of substances, that's when like my love for basketball and everything went downhill. And I guess my life took a turn for the worse, man, from then. So.
Yeah, so what age was that?
Man, once again, I was a late bloomer for all that, bro. I mean, like, let's go back a little bit and talk about my family, man. Mm-hmm. Like, I grew up in an amazing family. Like, when I say amazing, I'm not just, you know, talking shy of just, you know, a local professor, you know, just like a doctor. But I'm talking about UN officials, diplomats, Harvard graduates, CEOs. But, like, these guys weren't just normal, you know, professionals in their craft, but they were like doing it on the next level. They were doing it in like places like West Africa or the Caribbean or South America, giving back to like huge communities and villages, bro, through their craft. And I looked up to these guys, man, like they're like the coolest people in the world. I wasn't really looking at I wasn't looking at how they were doing it. I was looking at what they were doing. Right. And what I mean by that, it was like I was looking at the fact that these guys were academics. These guys were like successful and very prominent figures within their industries. And so I tried so hard to be like them. I love to be like them. I just wanted to be like them. And then it's weird, man, because the more you try to be someone you're not, the further you go away from yourself. And that's when you really have lost yourself. You get me? And I was losing myself every single day by wanting to be someone else, bro. It was profound. It's profound stuff. And like when you're not yourself and when you're losing yourself, that's when like true deep-rooted insecurities come about. You're never going to be happy, bro. Never, ever, ever.
So I read a little bit, just quickly to jump in.
No, not at all.
I read a little bit about your parents,
yeah,
about what they did growing when you were growing up. And
yeah,
they were traveling a lot. They were
heaps,
helping out
heaps, bro.
Cultures and communities and everything all around the world.
Heck yeah.
And before we jump to where you think you're leading there.
Yeah.
Did you travel much with them? How'd they work? Were they away a lot?
No, not at all, actually. Because the thing is, I was born and raised in Japan, bro. So that's because they actually came to Japan to embrace that culture and to learn and give back in their own rights. You get me? So then that's why we left and I just traveled from Japan. We went to America and in Canada. Before that, my parents actually met in the Philippines. But they're from Iran. It's crazy, though, man. Like, the reason my mom went to the Philippines was because... So she was 18 years old and she was married to a man, but because we're not Muslim, we're Baha'is. And Baha'is believe in all faiths. And whether you're religious or not, man, we're still one. Do you get me?
Yep.
And we find common ground in the fact that we're creatures, living, breathing, you know, creatures. And so my mom wasn't a Muslim, but the husband was. And after like 2 weeks of my mom having her first daughter, her first child, as a fact. Not many people know this. This is kind of crazy. They took my sister, I guess, away from my mother. And when I say they, I'm talking about the ex-husband and the family, because my mom was a Muslim. And they're like, we don't want a Baha'i raising my granddaughter. Or, yeah, basically that's what happened. And my mom, man, boss woman, man, 18 years old, was like, all right, I've just had to deal with the hardest thing of my life. What am I going to do? Am I going to sulk and grieve and just hate my life? Or am I going to do something for the world? And so she just bounced and moved to the Philippines, man. And like went to like the bush in the south. Lived in the rural areas, giving back, man, doing everything she can. Because you can't go to the police, man, and just be like, yo, they took my baby away. Because they were like, all right, cool, what's the reason? Oh, because, you know, I'm a Baha'i. And they'll be like, Because Baha'is to this day, bro, 2019, cannot even, we don't even have basic human rights. And they can't go to university, bro. They're looked as second class, not even second class citizens. They're not even looked as citizens. It's profound, man. Like after the revolution in the 80s, Baha'is, Jews, Christians, a lot of people had to leave the country because of the persecution. Deaths, my uncle, people would get killed and murdered and, you know, just how it is for the faith. But nothing against Islam at all either, bro. You know, it's just purely the fanatic government that just wanted to control. And they found any potential threat from the outside communities as a reason for them to, I think, I guess you can talk about any kind of government, any kind of authority. When there's a threat, they'll do everything in their power to expel it. And to expel it, they'll use extreme force. And it's just how it is. So it has nothing to do with religion, bro. It's just straight up power and just fanaticism. So
early on in your life, your mum's gone through that and you knew it early on. You were bouncing around a lot, but you were bouncing around a lot early just because they were trying to help. They were trying to, she's gone through something and she said, righto, I'm going to give back to communities that don't have it as good as
others. Straight up, bro. Straight up.
And that was everything. That was Canada. That was America. That was Japan.
Yep. And my dad was the same too, man. Like my dad left when he was 18. He went to Afghanistan and then the Taliban started getting kind of big and hectic there. Taliban's being an extreme group as well. Mm-hmm. So he decided to go to the Philippines and that's where they met. And then they moved to Japan. And then from Japan, it was Canada, America. Then it was Vancouver, Canada. And everything was good there, man. And then finally, that's where we settled. For the first time in a long time, we settled there. And that's the thing. I was the youngest of three boys. And like what happened was my older brothers, they were, you know, like I said, just awesome members of the community. And like they were just basically like the rest of my family, just always wanted to give back. And so they had gone all around the world as well. So my brother went to Tonga, lived there for a year in Samoa. The other one went all around the Pacific. He went to like Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands, and lived in the bush and tried to do everything. And like they were just kicking ass, bro. And like I just did everything and I admire them so much, bro. And I want to do everything they did. Same subjects in school, same sports they played. I'm into basketball because of my brothers, bro. You know what I mean? I didn't get to choose my favorite player. My oldest brother chose him for me. He was Kevin Johnson, the point guard of the Phoenix Suns, because his favorite player was Charles Barkley, who was like the power forward of the Phoenix Suns or center. I'm not sure.
Yep.
And so, yeah, it's just how it was, man. Like I looked up to them. I admire them, man. I got their names tattooed on my eyelids, brother, just because I look up to them so much. You get me? The metaphor, G. The metaphors, bro. It's pretty cool. So I got Nemo on one side and Nadim on the other. It's pretty fun. And so, yeah, they did that. And then I guess, like I said, going back, the more I try to be like them, the further away it went from myself. And that's when the insecurity started coming along. And no one in my family, bro, if you're a Baha'i especially, you don't do any mind-altering substances as we've been created as pure and noble creatures. So if we do anything that's going to affect that sobriety or that state of mind, we're going further away from our nobility. So I never grew up with that stuff in my house. But that was the one thing that I was able to, I guess, through my extensive hours of playing basketball in like the hood park, I guess, around the corner from my house. There were kids always smoking weed and just chilling there. And after many, many months of me just always hanging around there, I had my first joint. And man, that was the first time I felt like I belonged or something happened, because I was able to like get high and I got pretty high. So I felt like I was pretty good at it. You know what I mean? It's crazy. But that's how it happened, man.
What age were you?
17, 16 or 17, yeah. And after that, I was like, yeah, you know what? Scratch this. This is an escape. So I just started smoking weed. And I felt like if I didn't have to just live in that insecurity and that deep-rooted hatred that I had about the fact that I couldn't be who they were, even though I tried so hard, at least I can get high and I can do that good. You know what I mean? Which is ironic because, like, I mean, it's not hard to get high.
Yeah, but it's probably like almost a little community for you of people.
Yeah, exactly.
Going, doing the same thing though. Like you can do what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not like you're going to get better or worse. If you just keep doing and keeping up, then you're all right. You're on the same level.
And did your family have any idea when you're smoking a bit of weed?
I mean, when I was smoking a bit of weed, nah. But then it got to a point where like the bit of weed turned to like, you know, a bit of pills, a bit of shrooms, a bit of hallucinogenics. And then that's when it started getting big. You know what I mean? And I started just, it's just crazy, man. You know what, like the one of the biggest trips in the world is when you're doing something, or when I was doing the substances and escaping that reality, yeah, I would sober up and I'd feel such shame and embarrassment of who I was that the only thing that could help me out was more drugs, right? So that's why it was just like it is literally a gateway, right? And like I just kept getting higher and higher and higher. And the more I would do it, the more shame I felt about myself, the more shame I felt about myself, the more I would do it. Then it got to a point where like, yeah, I just like, I guess cocaine was like the, like I say this in one of my documentaries, but it was one of the best experiences of my life because not because it was awesome high voice. I'm saying because it was just the one thing that led my life to go from like hero to zero instant, right? Like bad. I went from 100 to zero real quick. You get me? And so, yeah, it got to a point where like I couldn't even fit any more in my nostrils, bro. Like it would just fall out because it was just constantly filled with excess coke from the night before or like just mixture of snot and whatever the hell it was. Sorry for anyone who's listening, kind of grossed out. But and then, yeah, man, I guess that's the one thing. And I was doing this for myself, bro. Like, it's not even like hanging out. Let's go to a party. It was like no one wanted to hang out with me at this point. It was crazy. Like, I lost my girl. I lost my homies. My brothers were kind of like, nah, like, they've tried everything in their power to be there for me. But they had to push away, man, because I was bringing them down. My pops, the same thing, man. He's just like, nah, like, what am I supposed to do? And he was not living in the same city as us. And because he was working in Calgary, which is really close by. And so it was just me and my mom's, man. And I'm the baby. She's my mom. All the women out there, they're going to probably listen. Like, they can definitely relate if they're mothers, of course. I'm not saying anything against fathers, but I think there's a different chemical reaction between or connection.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
I totally agree.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not that the fathers don't care, but there's like I don't think a word can justify the emotions and the attachment that a mother could have for their child, especially their boy. You know what I mean? Their baby boy. Especially when you're as good looking as me, bro. Like, it's crazy.
So you,
I think all the moms out there.
I'm just kidding. So you, growing up, you're trying to be like your parents first, yeah. Then like your brothers, and it's not working.
Yeah.
And that sort of started to lead you down this path of you just wanted
escape.
Connection, escape with other things, and that's what you put it down to, looking back now?
Absolutely, man. It was pure insecurity. It was pure just doubt and no confidence within myself. And so, I meant to be honest with you, no, there are no addicts out there that are happy. Straight up. If you're genuinely happy in life, you're not addicted because you don't need that substance to get you out of that happiness, bro. You're trying to find a substance to escape that sadness, that deep-rooted whatever it is within yourself, that struggle. Turmoil, the animosity, bro, that you got within yourself. That's the only reason why you leave this state of mind. Find one person who's truly addicted to something and is actually a happy person. So that's what I was. I wasn't happy, bro.
Was there a moment, an experience that like made you think this is has to stop?
Yeah, there was, man. I guess
only if you're
no. Let's talk about it. I guess, man, this is real, man. I want everyone to hear this. So, like, when you're going through like serious moments in your life, right? And I guess like it really helps change. It's good for people to know, you know. And so this is my life. This is real. This is no exaggeration. So, the thing that happened to me was, remember I was telling you guys like I couldn't even fit any more coke into my nose because it would just fall out. So, y'all remember Red Hot Chili Peppers? Book Scar Tissue, from Anthony Kiedis, the lead singer. Yeah, so in the book he read, he would talk about how he would shoot coke and heroin and have a speedball. So it's a mixture, and I guess I just kind of read that and it intrigued me, and I was like, oh shit, you can shoot coke, you know? Not knowing these things, I didn't grow up with that kind of mentality or the lifestyle, and so that's what my next option was going to be, to shoot, you know, some of my coke that I had. But I was just thinking, where can I get needles? I was going to go to the pharmacy and get something. I just didn't know. But then I remembered my cat. This is messed up, but it's true. She's passed now, but she had diabetes. And my mom would have to inject insulin into her twice a day. So the vet gave us a heap ton of diabetic insulin needles for cats. So my mom had a whole bunch in the cupboard upstairs. And so I grabbed one of those. And then I went downstairs into the basement and I didn't know how to shoot because in the book, he would just talk about how he would shoot coke. but he never told me how, or he never told us how. And so I did the one thing that you can always figure out how to do stuff. Go to Google. Types in how to shoot cocaine, and sure enough, this is crazy, bro. Like, the amount of blogs and write-ups and everything that came up, like a WikiHow, like point by point. And you know, one thing that I was missing was like a wire cable, but my friend had left his Xbox. And so I grabbed the cable from the Xbox and I wrapped it around my bicep. So just think about this. Go back memory lane. This is 7.5 years ago. I have an Xbox cable wrapped around my bicep. I've got a needle filled with coke water that is used to inject inside cats, and just a bag full of dope and the rusted old spoon and some water. And yeah, man, I was just shooting it up all night. But this is how, like, how high of a junkie I was at the time. It's because I was too scared to waste even a drop or like a speck of coke, bro, that I didn't want to waste any of the water. So instead of like pushing out the needle from the back and like getting any excess air to come out the needle head, I kept it all in. And the reason you do that, I found out later, is because if air goes into your vein and goes up to your brain, pop goes the weasel, bro. But luckily, the reason why I didn't die, or I could have not died or had severe, you know, injury to my brain, was because the needle was so small, because it was for a cat. So there wasn't enough air that could be put in. Yeah, it's crazy. Wow. Think about it, man. Like, I'm still alive talking to this day based on the luckiest fluke. You know what I mean? So, yeah. I mean, like, that was the night, bro, that I kind of was one of the last nights that I did drugs. But the reason is because I woke up the next day. And it was like, you know, half the reason why you get high, I mean, you continue to get high, boys, is because you get sick. You get dope sick. Dope sick is the withdrawals you make and you get, sorry, from not being on a substance. And your body starts to crave it and needs it and gets sick. And the only thing that helps you out is when you take it again. And then you feel normal, which is crazy because your normal is under the effects of a substance. And so, yeah, my head was just pounding. I had a migraine. It was like 5 PM. And I just go upstairs. I'm like, I need to get money, you know. And I think, to be honest with you, the biggest superpowers are people who are addicted to drugs, because the reason why I say that is miracles happen. You go to sleep with 80 cents to your name, but you're able to wake up and feed like $100, $200, $300 habit daily. You know what I mean? It's crazy. How do you do that? How do you do that? Anyways, for me, this is how I did it that day specifically. I go up and I basically threaten my mom. Mom, give me some money. She's like, no, Nas, I don't have anything. You know, like, please. I'm like, Mom, give me some money. Give me some money. I need some food. But Nas, I've made food downstairs. Like, this lady would literally cut up so much fruit and veggies every time I'd go away. So I come home to a fresh batch of whatever it could be in the fridge. And then if I wouldn't show up for like 4 or 5 days, she would force herself to eat these things because it doesn't go old, and just redo it, always having fresh stuff in the fridge for me just to give nourishment to my body. Nas, please, I don't have anything. I don't have anything. Mom, give me some freaking money. I need some money for food. I don't want your damn food. I hate it. And she was just getting intimidated and scared, man. And so, sure enough, I guess I scared her enough to just go into her purse and just grab whatever change or bills or whatever. I don't remember. This is 8 years ago. Just out of her pocket or out of her wallet. And she gave it to me, and I basically called my friend saying, come downstairs, or come to my house, I'll meet you downstairs, let's go off and start our day. And so he calls me about 20 minutes later, and he tells me I'm downstairs, and my mom is in front of the door as I'm running out, and she's saying, please don't go. But in Farsi, it's Naro, Naro, Lotfan Naro, please don't go. And I'm charging at her like a bull, bro, you know, and just grab her and I push her up against the closet. You know, she hits the side. I just keep walking through. But this is the part that changed me, okay? It was the whimper. It was the sound of absolute desperation from my mom. It was so subtle. It was like, like that. Like, it was like a very, very soft whimper. And I heard her ball her eyes out, bro. I've heard her scream at the top of her lungs. I've heard everyone scream at the top of their lungs, begging me to stop. But just went in one ear out the other. But it was that sound, bro, that really just kind of woke me up like that. Because it was the sound of the last person giving up on me. I mean, to be in that state, I gave up on myself a long time ago. And with my ex-girlfriend leaving me, with my friends slowly leaving me, my mental health was gone. My brothers, my father, it's not like they left me, but they just had to take a step back. But everyone else had left me. I had nothing going for me, bro. The only person I could always rely on coming home to and knowing they were going to be there with an open house, open roof, open fridge was my mom. And now is the sound of, there's nothing else I can do for you. I looked down on my wrist. I looked down on my biceps. I looked down on my forearms, black and blue. Look up into the sky. It was a gross, gloomy afternoon in Vancouver, you know? And I just remember thinking to myself, fuck, something needs to change, boys. And so I go into my friend's car. I was too much of a coward to look back at my mom that day. But then I look at my friend. I say, bro, I've got a problem. I need to change. And he goes, absolutely, man. You needed to change a long time ago. And so I checked myself into rehab pretty much right after. And that was 7 years ago. And I've been sober since, boys.
So, wow. Thanks for that, mate. Yes. That's a powerful story, especially to tell on a platform like this. Very powerful. It's pretty powerful that you made that decision yourself and you checked yourself in essentially with that moment with your mum, but also you've just made that decision. You've gone to your mate. You've said that you needed to change and you've gone and done it. You deal with people in this position a lot these days with what you're doing, and we'll get to that down the track. Do you look back with some pride? Probably not the word, because I don't think you have much pride at that time in your life. But do you look back individually with some type of pride that you were able to do that?
I mean, replace the word pride with bounty. Pride is all good, but I'm going to say, like, I'm proud that I did that, but I'm more blessed that I got to do that, bro. Do you get me?
Mm. Yep.
I should be proud of it, but I don't think it was on me. That's why I shouldn't be proud. I'm more blessed that I had the bounties of having a mother like that, bro. Of having brothers that have tried for years and years and years for the intervention. For having a father who's done everything he can, bawling his eyes out 4 or 5 days a week on the phone with me. The other two, I just wouldn't pick up his calls. So I had the bounties and the blessings of a family that loved me, bro, and wanted nothing but the best for me. They weren't just saying, oh, he's a fuck up. They were actually thinking, what can we do? What can I sacrifice? My brother was supposed to go to a trip. I think he was supposed to go to Cuba too, man. Like, but this is the night before I stole a car high on Zanny's, bro. And I crashed into a cab, totaled the car. And he had to come basically fly home to take care of my mom, because my mom had to go pick me up from the hospital, passed out. Do you get me? Like, they made sacrifices for days, bro. My other brother basically housed me in his apartment as a uni student for like 4 months, bro. So I didn't have to go to rehab, and that was my rehab without going to rehab. And the sacrifices he made in his final year of university. Like, I'm blessed to have people like that in my life. I'm blessed that I had a family that was so devoted, man, in giving back, that they just did everything they could to give back to me as well. And so I'm proud of my family. I've got pride in my family. I'm just blessed to have them. So I am proud. I do have pride, but it's not just within me.
Yep.
You get me?
Yeah, be dumb.
So you can probably sympathize with people who don't, who've been in your position, didn't have a family like you had. Is that a powerful motivating factor for you to try and help people?
Tui, that's like exactly the thoughts that go on through my head, especially on the streets, bro. I mean, a lot of these men and women, bro, hadn't had a chance.
Can I just jump in quickly here?
Yeah, 100%.
For people who don't know out there, we haven't actually talked about the streets barber yet much.
Cool.
But that's what Naz is doing now. He's a streets barber, and it's a bit of a movement more than anything.
More or less.
I mean, clean cut, clean start is sort of like your motto.
Yeah, I mean, that was the initiative, or like the thing that was started from the beginning, but I think it's kind of changed now through clean cut, clean start. and we're venturing off more to we, not me. Because, I mean, clean cut, clean start is like the barber aspect of it, but I'm really on the mission of trying to allow everyone to understand the potential and the capacity to serve others. So it shouldn't just be with like a pair of scissors and clippers. It started off with a pair of scissors and clippers. I would say like clean cut, clean start is like a day one, but we, not me is like eternity. You get me?
And then just going back onto Reg's question, just saying it was, that's what leads you to do what you do now with it.
Yeah. I mean, if you guys, I can quickly touch base on the streets thing and how that all started.
Yeah, go on, please.
Cool. So when I went to rehab, I finally realized what I want to do for myself, you know? And it wasn't just try to be like everyone else, but it was to do what I wanted to do. And throughout like my 6-7 years on drugs, I used to always just give haircuts to my friends and like my brothers and stuff. And they were like, all right. I'm not gonna say they're the best, but they were all right. Like, you know, for someone who doesn't know how to cut hair and use beard trimmers and kitchen scissors, you know what I mean? Like straight up, it was cool. So they would always tell me you should be a barber, blah, blah, blah. And I'd always get mad. Like, is that all you guys think I'm capable of doing, man? You don't think I'm capable of being an academic or a professor, UN official, blah, blah, blah.
There's a quote in that I read.
Yeah.
Nah, man, I want to do something that's going to be respected in society.
Word up, bro. Yeah, you're doing your homework. I like that. I like that.
And I think that's, it's an interesting one because you touched on it just then. I think a lot of people around have thoughts on certain jobs that aren't respected, with quotation marks, in society. Mm-hmm. And you're going to touch on it then, but I just wanted to chuck that comment.
Yeah, bro, 100%. Elaborate on. 100%. And, you know, I remember one day, like, my mom was just like, Ness, whatever you do, so long as you do it in the spirit of service, we don't care, bro. And so I never realized that, but like what she was really saying, but I just kind of knew that that's not what I wanted to do. I thought it was a swear word, be a barber. I was like, what are you insulting me for, bro? And then in rehab, that's when I was like, you know what? Like, who cares? Let me just do it. People don't respect me, it's all good. They're sure as hell going to respect me more than just being, you know, like a junkie, bro. So, I mean, I was dedicated. I was focused. I gave my mom her son back when I got out of rehab. She looked at me the very first day I got out and she just like penetrated my soul, bro. And I swear, I thought she was like trying to see if I was high or something, because like she was really looking into my eyes. I said, Mom, what's up? And she goes, Nasir, this is the first time I can see someone behind your eyes in 6 years. That's some powerful stuff, man. Anyways, a few months of just being with my mom and just kicking it at home, Vancouver, my dad coming to visit and everyone being a family again. My oldest brother, who was here doing his master's at Melbourne Uni, was like, bro, come to Melbourne, live with me. You know, we can try to start your craft and career and cutting hair and take it more seriously here. There's an awesome market. I think you'll do really well. Sure enough, I was like, all right, cool. It just seemed perfect. It just seemed like it was meant to be. And so I moved down 7 years ago on a one-way ticket. Not sure what my next plan was going to be, but I was like, all right, let's just give it a shot. And so came here, no one wanted to give me an opportunity, bro. No one, because I was just a kid with no experience and a visa. True. So, I mean, like, it's just, nah. I'm like, you guys hiring? Oh, yeah, what can you do? It's like, I mean, I don't know, not much. Like, oh, sorry, right? You know what I mean? But, I mean, that didn't give me any doubt that I wasn't going to be a barber still. And so I worked as a barista for a long time. And on my days, actually, not even my days off, bro. Like, after hours, I would rush to a barbershop and watch them how to cut hair. You know, and I'll do like a 10-hour shift at a cafe, waking up at like 5, finish at whatever time, and just rush to a barbershop and watch the last 2-3 hours. And then eventually I got to sit inside and I would just grab the phone. I would brush up the hair. And soon enough, they would start telling me, Ness, like, this is how you do this. I would ask questions and then they would answer. And they're like, yo, do you want to bring a friend in? We can do training. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. And then I would go home, man. And I, I would go home, practice on my friends, but then I'd watch YouTube videos before I go to sleep on how to cut hair. Then I'd come back to work and practice what I just learned. And it was just like a cycle. And then one day the lady's just like, yo, the lady of the shop, she owned the shop. I'm just a lady, as if you guys would know who I'm talking about. The lady. So she was like, do you want an unofficial apprentice, man? Apprenticeship. We'll give you $10 an hour, just cut hair. And I was like, bro, man, that's like $9.50 more than I expected. I was so excited for that. I was like, absolutely. So I quit my job as a barista, 2 years deep, just busting my ass, bro, just trying to get, you know, an opportunity. And it was great because, I mean, I would just give haircuts and I wasn't the best at it, But the one thing I started to realize was people were requesting to get their haircut from me. And it was wild, bro. Like, I was like so shocked. I couldn't believe it because I hated the way I cut it. I was always so like sad because I wasn't as good as everyone else. But this is just going back to how I would always think, bro. Always comparing myself, right? And then this all changed when the lady who gave me the opportunity had a crush on this dude. And this dude would always get his haircut from her. And she wouldn't let me cut everyone's hair because she thought I wasn't good enough. So it was only for like old people or people who weren't regulars and everything else. But still, I at least got a position at a shop. And then one day she had gone and this dude came and I was available. He's like, yeah, I'll just get a haircut with you. And, you know, we had a good time. He just left and I told the boss, I was like, yo, I cut his hair, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, oh no, man, Nas, what the hell? And like very upset. And I was like, what? Just broke me down. But I was like, he seemed happy. Sure enough, boys, 3 weeks later, he rocks up. Hey, can I get a haircut? He's like, yeah, absolutely. I can fit you in, blah, blah, blah. Nah, I want to go with Nas. Like, what? And so when she found out and she heard that, she was like losing it, bro. What the hell? That kid's dust on my feet. You know, like he can't cut for shit. But it just made me realize, I think 80% of dudes out there, they like a good haircut, but a good haircut to an amazing haircut is almost the same. But a good time to an amazing time are huge differences. And that's what I had with the dude, man. It was just an amazing time. And so I realized the power and the benefit that we have, or the capacity and the opportunity we have as barbers or hairdressers to really help someone's mood and emotions go from whatever they're, you know, feeling for the day, and then making it 10 times better just from that encounter. Because they're trusting us with their image. The vulnerability is huge, and they're sitting there to eventually look better. Because they've come to us for a problem. The problem is that they're just not happy with the way they look. So they want to look better. It's crazy. So I guess after that I realized, man, like, I need to start doing this for people who were in my similar situation in the past. I used to hate myself. I used to come home and just look at myself in the mirror and bawl my eyes out. I hated the way I looked. I hated the way I felt. I hated the way I thought. And so one day I saw this homeless guy outside. I was like, bro, you want a haircut? And his eyes lit up. And I was like, he's like, absolutely. I've been too depressed to look at myself in the mirror to groom myself. I would love this opportunity. That's powerful, man. Like some guy who's too depressed to look at himself in the damn mirror, bro. He just hated the way he looked. He hated the way he felt. He hated the way he thought. Who does that remind you of, bro? Do you get me? Yeah. So I was like, all right, man, I took it upon myself, got my clippers out, scissors. Man, this dude was just so confident throughout the haircut. He was chirping at girls across the road. Hey, honey, what you doing after? You know what I mean? Like, hey, boys, I got the best barber in town giving me a haircut. And so, like, it was so dope. And then people were walking by bawling their eyes out, man. They were like, you're doing such a good job, you know. And this guy was, like, laughing and joking, and it was just a crazy experience. And then I'm like, this is what I need to do. This is what I need to do. And right there, then and there, I realized, wow, man, this is what my mom kept saying. Whatever you do, do it in the spirit of service, bro. And what service meant to me, I've started to realize, was it's not about like going to Africa and building a school, or like going to Thailand and working with elephants, or, you know, doing some stint at like an orphanage, which is dope. And if that's your capacity, do it. But service is just making sure you're of benefit to someone else. That's it. You can do that in your workplace, getting paid millions. You can do that for free as a nun in a church. You can do whatever you can so long as you're a benefit to someone else, bro. That's service. And that's what I was doing as a barber, bro. I was being of service to others by making them feel, think, and look better. I'd like to say look, but I'm not the best barber. But still, bro, like I like to think that, right? And so that's when I go back. Now, guys, remember how earlier on I said I was looking at my family on what they were doing, not how they were doing it. It all made sense, dog. Like, what they were doing was meaningless. How they were doing it, they were doing it in the spirit of service, bro. They were serving kids in Africa at an orphanage as a doctor physician to serve these kids, not just to kind of work in a medical center and prescribe medicine. There's two different types of doctors. There's those doctors and there's these doctors. You get me? So, like, it was a spirit of service, bro.
You're doing that job for us. We can just sit here, you just do it perfectly for us.
Yeah, but the thing about, obviously, go overseas and all that stuff is great. It's, when it comes to mental health especially, you shouldn't be fooled into thinking this is a problem on the other side of the world. Like, you don't have to look very far to find people who need help. I don't know how many people have to be hugely successful, super famous, some of them, and Robin Williams.
Word, bro.
Commits suicide, has the world at his feet. Like, it's totally universal.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to look very far to have a significant impact in someone's life. I think that's why people love, like, all your videos on YouTube, you just having a chat with these people. It's super powerful because they're people you walk past in the street. This isn't like a charity box with, you know, kids, help kids in Africa. Again, like a wonderful cause, but it's easy mentally to put that to one side and say, that's somewhere else. Like, you can kind of ignore that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so easy to ignore people walking past you in the street. And those are the people you're cutting hair.
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask, because I watched a lot of these videos, and how do you cope with the stories they're telling you? I know you've been through a lot, but I watched one, and you were cutting these people's hair. I think it's only 6-7 months ago. And they each told you a different story of their depression. Mm-hmm, and they each told you a story of how they tried to commit suicide at different points in their lives. How do you keep the bad stuff at bay? Because you are exposing yourself to
bro,
a lot of negativity, really.
Therapy, bro. Like, I'm confidently going to say this. I see a therapist, bro, because I need to kind of like unwind.
Mm.
And I need, like, every counselor sees another counselor. Every therapist sees a therapist. I need that too. You know, I see it once and every now and then, just unwind my chest, you know, and it's totally normal. I used to hate therapy, bro, thinking it was for people who were sick. But it's not, man. It's to avoid getting sick. Straight up. People who are sick go there to get less sick, essentially. I go there to unwind, to open myself and, like, refer. Like, man, I feel really bad about this. I feel really bad about this. How can I cope? And then it's just, like, awesome coping mechanisms, bro. That's what therapists do. Instead of giving you a pill to numb you, which is what I, like, really, really am staying away from 110%, it's about, let me teach you these tips on how to numb you, essentially. Well, not really numb. It's, like, more acceptance.
Yeah.
Mindfulness and all these things, man, where in a way it's not that it numbs you, but you feel the sensation, but the sensation is almost numbing because you're just accepting it as it is. You know, it's powerful stuff. I did a 12-day meditation thing out in, like, South Australia in the bush, where it was just the ancient techniques of the Buddha, Vipassana. Man, that was one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life, bro. Harder than rehab, 100%. Harder than my drug addiction and everything, bro. Just, like, sitting there in silence and just tapping into the far depths of your mind, bro. Oh, my God.
I was going to touch on this later.
Yeah?
Because we've actually got a mutual friend that's just come back from it.
True.
Vipassana.
Vipassana. It's like it's an Hindu word. Who's your friend?
Tyler.
Yeah, dude. She's dope, man. Like, I met her ages ago. She came and did, like, a little story and documentary, not documentary, but like a filming thing.
Some of these questions are from her, actually.
True.
She told me to ask you about it.
Shout out, girl.
She'll be wrapped with that. But she's just come back from it. And she said it was the hardest but best thing she's ever done.
Absolutely,
and
man.
And I wanted to hear your thoughts on it, because there's something I might think of doing down the track.
Oh, bro, if you're going to do it, man, and I highly recommend everyone to do it, just make sure you're not expecting anything. And the one thing that, you know, it's really funny when you think you're going away for a meditation retreat, you know, you're just going to think of, like, getting away, I'm just going to have some fun, I'm just going to go to Bali and just get a wellness retreat.
Can you explain it a little bit what it is to everyone out there?
Bro. Yeah. You sit in a room with a couple monks. No one can look at your eyes. No one can contact you. No one can speak to you. You're removed from everything. And you meditate from the moment you wake up, which is at 4:30 in the morning with a loud gong, till 9 p.m. at night, with only 2 meals a day, 3 breaks. And you sit there in mental silence. No one can talk to you. You don't have no phone, no pen, no paper, nothing. And you just feel sensations after sensations after sensations. And it was one of the most powerful and the most amazing experiences I've ever had in my life. But it was the hardest thing I've ever had to deal with. Because when we're so used to, how hard is it for when you wake up in the morning and not look at your phone? That's pretty damn hard. But why do you need that? Because you need to escape the reality, bro. That's what it is, man. We're prisoners of stimulus. And so when you're put somewhere and you're such a prisoner and you're free, it's crazy because you can't leave anything. And so, even when I'm saying free, I mean free of stimulus. And like when you're sitting there and you have nothing to distract you or occupy you or kind of like allow you to not think about this or not remember that, but you have no choice but to think about it and no choice but to remember that. Some of the stuff that I realized when I was meditating was crazy because I had fully forgotten about it for like 8 years, 9 years, 10 years. And I sat there like on my fifth, sixth day and I was like, oh my God, that happened. Oh my God, dude. And I just didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to feel. I didn't know what to think. But I couldn't do anything. I couldn't talk about it.
How long ago did you do it?
6 months ago. Yeah, man, it was one of the hardest things, bro. Like, I mean, I do a whole, on the fifth day, it's not day by day. It's hour by hour. On the eighth day, it wasn't hour by hour. It was minute by minute. On the last day, bro, it was second by second. I was looking at the time. Oh my God, I needed to get up. But I finished it and I just felt like a wave of like accomplishment. And that's when I would say pride. Because I did something that was so hard. The thing is, man, like when you're meditating and you're trying to feel the sensations, when you're angry, you're thinking about the thoughts, right? Oh, why did Lockie say this to me, man? Oh, what, you know, he's a bastard. He thinks he's taller than me. You know what? I'm taller than him, bro. You know what I mean? But it's just like we start thinking about the words or the actions or whatever happened. We don't actually realize the sensation within our body. And so, have you not noticed that when you get angry, you turn red or you feel hot? It's because the sensation of like fire is within us. So when someone says something, instead of thinking about what they've said, you focus on the sensation that comes with that experience. So if you say something to me like, you're an idiot, Barbara, and I hate the way you cut, I can listen to those words and get angry based on that, or I can feel the sensation that comes with those words, which is probably going to be fire. I put all my energy into feeling that sensation. And the more I feel that sensation, the less I'm thinking about what you said. And then before you know it, man, it fizzles out. And that's true distraction. And then it may not fizzle out completely, but it'll fizzle out enough without me having to react the way I would have when I was really mad. 10 out of 10 mad, I might be 9 out of 10 mad. You keep doing this, next time will be 8 out of 10, 7 out of 10. Before you know it, you're walking around. You don't care about a world. You don't care about a thing. You don't care about anything, bro. It's so amazing. It's hard, though. And so one time I was feeling these sensations. This is crazy, boys. So I'm sitting there and I see these monks and they were just like kind of like moving back and forth like in a circle with their eyes closed. And I'm like, what the hell are they doing, man? And finally, I felt this feeling after 8 days when I was feeling the sensations in my body. I felt like there were vibrations, bro, like all throughout my head, down to my toes, up through my back. And I was just shaking and I was just going, my eyes were closed, but I honestly felt like it's unexplainable. And I had to open my eyes because it was so profound. And I was just sitting in the same position. I was like, what the hell just happened? And I closed my eyes again and I haven't felt it since. But that's what they were feeling, bro. It's just feeling the sensations in your body because you're so in tune and you have such mental silence that you're able to feel what your body's doing, bro. It's so crazy. There's a reason why these monks take themselves away from these hills like hundreds of miles away, bro, and just don't do anything for the rest of their lives but chill out with 12 other blokes, all happy and like chubby Asian dudes, you know what I mean? Just sitting there with shaved heads.
That's awesome.
Bro, it's profound, man.
Yeah, I've listened to people talk about like intense mindfulness and its power. And it's literally what you just said. It's being aware of the feelings, not trying to hide them or bury them down. It's if you're really aware of what it is you're feeling, you can control it a lot better and mm-hmm. you can control how it affects you. Mm-hmm. So like you said, if you're just fuming, if you're super angry, you can actually just acknowledge what you're feeling. It's like this sensation I have right now is anger. It'll pass. And you can use it for stress and anxiety. You can be aware of what it is you're feeling. Sam Harris talks about it a lot. And once you're fully aware of what these sensations are, they're much easier to deal with and cope with and kind of not let them control your thoughts. Absolutely. Or actions. Like it's pretty powerful stuff.
Very powerful. The Chinese have this awesome, like, man, the Chinese are badass, yeah. Bro, straight up. But they had this awesome saying from back in the day. It's like some kind of like spiritual doctrine. You can't prevent birds of sadness from flying over your head, but you can prevent them from making nests in your hair. It probably sounds way better in like Mandarin.
Sounded pretty good.
But it's pretty damn dope, bro. And like, I have a big tattoo on my stomach, and it's just a dude in prison. You can just see the hands, and it's from a Baha'i writing, a quote of the greatest prison is the prison of self. And once one is freed from that prison of self, that is indeed freedom. Something along those lines, heavily paraphrasing, but the greatest prison is the prison of self. And it's true, man. We are that greatest prison.
Stop.
Yeah.
Let's go back. Let's go back to when you started.
Cool.
Just when you started doing the haircuts for the homeless.
Yeah. So that experience was dope. After that, I was like, man, this is cool. Like, this is what I need to do. And I started doing it.
Were you scared?
Yeah. Hell yeah, bro. It's because I don't know much about it. So like, you see, like in a lot of my videos at first, or even photos from back in the day, I'd always have a backpack just because I had to have everything in there, just making sure, not like weapons and shit, but like I couldn't leave everything out on the ground. I was just, and I always had like sanitizer. I had my phone. I had my wallet, everything just close to me. I'd be going to like the sketchiest parts of Footscray, bro. I started going to the city a couple times, but I found the more I went to the city, the more of a spectacle it became.
Yeah.
And I wasn't doing it for that. I really was trying to do it for the person. And so Footscray seemed quite raw. And people would think like, oh, you're doing it for the clout. But I mean, dog, I'm doing it 5 years later. Yeah. And I've had the clout. Big time, bro. You know what I mean? And then the clout goes away. I'm still doing it. The clout comes back again. It goes away. I still do it, bro. I've had like my 15 minutes like 3-4 times now, you know what I mean? And I'm still doing it, bro. But now I'm trying to do bigger and better things. Because I'm sincere about it, bro. I would like to think. And that's the one thing that I will say confidently without trying to sound arrogant. I'm genuinely sincere about it, bro. I promise you guys and anyone who's listening, if no one was to know what I did, Instagram wasn't around, all the media production companies and everybody else who's done a story has not actually been published, I wouldn't have changed a damn thing, bro. I promise you that.
Have you been dealing with much stigma?
In what way? Negative stigma?
Negative stigma.
I mean, there's always going to be haters, bro. Like, you can find dirt on Dalai Lama, bro, or like Mother Teresa. People just get jealous. People just love to put down. But I mean, that's just, to be honest, I love that. Like, in a weird way, because I have a whole bunch of friends and they just laugh at me so much and like make fun of me. And it's just what we do. And so when people try to make fun of me, like, especially on like Facebook or Instagram, like I'll like the comment just because it's just like, I don't know what else to say, bro. Like, it's just, I'm not going to give a, but then sometimes people get like, try to defend me and they become like vigilantes, bro. And just like, get back at them. And I'm like, no, not on my page. So I'll delete both their comments. I'll put them in a private message, the three of us. And I'll say, guys, this isn't what the page is about. And then sometimes one person will be like, oh, I'm so sorry. Thank you so much. We love what you do, blah, blah, blah. But like, I mean, like, for example, this is so funny. This is my favorite one. So for anyone who doesn't know what I look like, I'm a Persian kid, and I used to have a big beard back in the day.
Super hot.
Thanks, bro. Thank you so much. Thank you. You're going to get some root canals, bro, from this eye candy. Look out. So what happened was those my Pilgrim documentary. That was the first thing that got a little bit of love from around the world. People were commenting everywhere, man, like about my tattoos. Like, yeah, he looks like a nice guy, but his tattoos, blah, blah, blah. And it's just so funny, right? And then one person wrote this and I loved it. And my friends all laughed like so hard. But he just goes, see, not all Muslims are terrorists.
Oh, Jesus.
So outrageous. I'm not Muslim. I'm not a terrorist, but I'm a brown guy with a beard trying to help someone on the streets. It's just so freaking funny, man. Some of this stuff and the stigma and the bullshit that comes through. Oh, Muslim or terrorists.
Some stuff is so daft. It's like, it doesn't even merit getting angry.
That's why I'm laughing, bro, because it's so outrageous. And it's just like, anyways.
Like, we've talked about social media a bit in this, and like, people are just so removed that like, they're not even really saying that about you. Like, they're just typing it because it's kind of funny and they'll just go on about their day. They would never dream of saying something like that to your face. We talk about it a bit of footy. Like, we played bad for a couple of weeks. You could post something. I could post a picture with my kids. This doesn't happen very often, but this is like, you could post something totally innocuous and somebody will come along and say, oh, have you been dropped yet? You should be out of the side. And I'm just kind of like, would you say that to me if I walked past you in the street? You'd probably ask me to sign something for you. Yeah, like, they're just, like, groveling. It's not real. It's not real.
It's not. And it's actually funny, man. Like, and I don't mean to say this in a rude way if anyone's going to listen to this and they follow and they write a comment, but I try my hardest not to even read the comments, whether it's praise or not. And most of the time, people are very, very lovely and they're praising, but I just don't want to add my or fuel my ego in any way, shape, or form. So I usually have close ones in my like team or like my family who just do comment control. So if there's anything that like is worth reading, like that I need to read because it's urgent or whatever it is, they'll do it for me. But if it's like, thank you, like, love you, blah, 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 I'll just like, I'll appreciate it deep down. I know I do, but I try my hardest not to. Before, okay, so I've done trips around the world to do some of the Streets Barber stuff. And my best experience was in Harlem. So I used to try to stay so humble when I was doing this that people would be like, man, I love the work that you do. Thank you so much, blah, blah, blah. And I'd be like, nah, I don't do anything. It's all good. I was, you know, I can kind of like dismissing what they were saying. And then one time, this like old Latino dude, he was super, super cool, just kind of sits me down and goes, love what you're doing, man. You know, you're like a saint. And I was like, honestly, I'm not doing anything special. I'm just like, you know, and he just kind of shuts me in. He goes, Ness, just appreciate what I'm saying and say thank you. And I was like, I'm taken back by that. He goes, because you're all about giving a service. Now let me serve you by praising you. Don't dismiss me. And I was like, whoa, damn, I never thought of it like that. I was trying to be so humble that I was doing a disservice. So after that, now I'll just appreciate it. I'll say thank you. But I always like to reverse the conversation on the person if I'm seeing them face to face. And it gets to a point, like, even in my barbershop, bro, or like, oh, it's so funny. People are like, yeah, you know about that barber who gets a haircut to the homeless? Or like, I've seen that tattoo in a documentary before. And they're talking about me. I'm like, oh, yeah, cool. Like, who are you talking about? I swear to God, bro. And people are like, why don't you tell them it's you? Because I'm like, because I know deep down I really want to tell them it's me. But I'm fighting my ego. And then I end up winning, bro. And I love it. I love it. I get off on the moments like that, bro. So, yeah, it's interesting. So stigma, man, you get so much different kinds of stigma.
I want to play you a little excerpt, and you're going to have to bear with us here because it's going to go for a little bit.
Easy, bro. But I mean, shit. Is it going to go longer than me talking, bro? Come on.
No, it's from one of my favorite podcasts. I've actually just started listening again in preparation for a bit of this, but it's something that Zach told me on the way here that you're starting as well. It's from Tim Ferriss, and it's Catherine Hoke. And it's called on this, it's called the Master of Second Chances or something about second chances. And she's all about second chances. And what she does is she goes into prisons in the US. She's got her own business and it's all about entrepreneurs in training. So when she talks about EITs, it's about convicts in prison and she's teaching them just to be better human beings and then also rehab out of prison to make them better people when they come out of prison. I'm just going to play this for you. It's going to go for a few minutes.
All good.
We'll just listen away.
The people I serve, we're all offenders. We all hurt people. And I think that when it comes to people who are in prison, there's this real us versus them mentality. Like they're in prison, they should rot in there. But when our volunteers come to prison with us, I ask them through that step to the line exercise some pretty challenging questions. Like, step to the line if you have ever been in a fight to prove yourself. Go all the way back to your childhood. Like, if you, even with a sibling, pulled their hair or punched a boy who was picking on you at the park or something like that, as a little kid, as a 7 or 8 year old, step to the line. And I would say that 70 or 80% of our volunteers are at the line on that. And then I say, step to the line if you've ever been, if you've ever committed a violent crime. And none of our volunteers are at the line, but close to 100% of our EITs are at the line. And I tell the volunteers, I must not be making myself clear. I did not say step to the line if you've been convicted of a violent crime. Step to the line if you've committed a violent crime. And earlier, 70 or 80% of you were at the line. When I asked if you've ever been in a childhood fight, step to the line, almost all of you were there. Well, the volunteers rolled their eyes at me because they're like, come on, you know, the little fight that I got in at the playground, that's not a violent crime. And I'm like, actually, if you looked at the backstories of the people that I serve, about half of them were arrested the first time before they were 10 or 11. And when I ask them for what, they say, oh, my mom was strung out and I broke into my neighbor's house to steal food because I was hungry. Or I was 10 and a 13-year-old was picking on me at the park, so I punched him in the face. you know, stuff like that. And so it's very easy for us to turn the other person into a villain, into a wild caged animal, to dehumanize the offender. But I can see myself in that offender. And I think that if we all look deep enough, many of us could see ourselves. And if you can't see yourself in that, I bet you could see your brother or your sister or your best friend. And if we were all known permanently for the worst thing that we've ever done, we might think a little bit differently about the labels that we attach to people. And unfortunately, once people go to prison or jail the first time, a lot of times officers will tell them on their way out, see you back here. And in our country, 76.6% of people are rearrested. Nearly everybody. If you go in once, it's a revolving door. And that is such a sad statistic.
Just a little insert from Tim Ferriss's podcast with Catherine Hoke.
Deep, bro.
And I played it for you purely because I hear you're doing some stuff out in bar and prison that you can elaborate on. I know Zach said
that's
that.
So funny. Yeah.
But also,
was I allowed to tell him that?
No, of course, no, you're allowed to tell. Like, I try to, like, once again, it's not a problem at all. I just try to keep it humble. So it's like, no, look what I'm doing. Look what I'm doing. So that's when I said, I'm doing bigger things now.
Yeah.
I was kind of like, that was what I was going to touch base on. But if you guys want to talk about it, let's do it.
Yeah. No, I just,
100%. Let's do it.
My question to that is that some people out there would be like, why homeless people? What do you get? Where's your happiness from helping the homeless people? Mm-hmm. And I was just listening back to that. It's one of my favorite podcasts I've listened to, and I'm going back and listening again. I reckon you should listen to it for sure as well.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
She's a brilliant lady, but I just wanted to get your feelings on it because I was watching you throughout it and just react to certain things that you were saying.
Yeah, it's crazy, bro, because I could assimilate so much on that. And I'm actually like down to talk about this too, because like I would have felt kind of cocky bringing it up on my own, like, look what I'm doing, man.
But so
I'm
so grateful. That's what we're here for.
Yeah,
mate,
thanks,
boy.
Yeah, no, it's cool because, like, you know, I haven't posted, like, on my Instagram, you see, none of this stuff has been talked about in the prisons just because one of the things I've tried to do is actually almost delete my Instagram several times. But, like, my team and, like, my bro, Nas, it's not about you, bro. It's about people who come to the page and derive inspiration. So, yeah, there's a couple selfies in me, but you got to give the fans what they want. You know what I'm saying? I'm kidding, boys. But like, my girlfriend's going to hate me for that. I love you, baby. Zarina, please don't judge me. So the thing is, like, I was going to do that, but my brother's like, it shouldn't be about you. So I guess that's kind of the concept of we, not me, and how that came up as well. It's about us. It's not about what my page is all about. And so the prison program is a huge thing for me. And I'm just trying to do that. And it's been 18 months in the process. I haven't put anything out. It's just been me and just purely serving and trying to stay as genuine. And when the time's right, maybe people can find out about it. But I guess, you know, like after you're saying it and obviously bringing it up, maybe people do need to know about that. And so
it's just a powerful thing to me.
Yeah,
listen
absolutely. Listen
to that as well, because I think it's human nature to tag people with certain things.
Straight
because
up.
Of things they've done, because of the way they look, because of the first conversation you had with them. It can be certain different things, but we tag people just, we judge a book by its cover. It's just
word,
human
bro.
Nature.
Yeah,
and that's the top line of it right there.
100%.
If they've been in jail, or if they've been a junkie, or if they've gone through rehab, or if they've got tattoos all over them, or don't, or if whatever it is.
People
love to judge. And she's just doing amazing things. And can you imagine the stigma she gets in America for dealing with, and she now deals with pretty much everyone as long as they want to change. She flat out says in it that if they don't want to change, she has nothing to do with them and doesn't want anything to do. But if she has someone, wouldn't you rather someone come out of jail that's been rehabilitized through her work than not?
Yeah, the one line like from that was, imagine being permanently known for the worst thing you've done.
Yeah, I know.
No one would have a good reputation, that's
no
for
way,
sure.
Bro.
And like prison does that.
Yeah, of course
if you're an ex-con,
of course.
It's very hard to shake that off.
Straight up, bro. And so going back to why I'm doing it, first of all, cutting hair has given me not a second chance, as that podcast is all about. It's given me my 100th chance. It's kept me on the right path. It's kept me sober. It's kept me motivated. It's given me purpose. And I'm hoping that if potentially one of my many, I guess, students, if you want to call them that, end up coming down a similar route that I went through after drugs or after, you know, jail or whatever it may be, then I guess it's a success. You know what I mean? And like you treat a dog like a dog, they're going to act like a dog. And I always say this, like, look at Tarzan. He was raised by what? But wasn't he raised by gorillas and stuff?
Yep.
You know what I mean? Or like by animals? It's like, it's just, and what did he become? Homie's swinging off trees, bro. Me, Tarzan, me, Jane. It's
a perfect analogy.
Bro, it really 100%, is. G. You know what I mean? And it's just, I guess you're a product of your environment, bro. So if like people around you are looking at you like you're worthless, you're going to act like that. You're going to react and you're going to rebel. Me giving these dudes the benefit of the doubt, I think has made them respect themselves a lot more too. Because I'm an outsider who's not working there. I'm coming purely on my own initiative. I'm not sent by, like, you know, the government to do a psych exam on you. I'm not sent by a church. I'm not sent by anyone just to kind of help you. I'm just purely just wanted to teach you guys how to cut. And these dudes, bro, like, I've never had so much authority given to me than the time I went to prison one of the first times and I met everyone. And I did a little presentation on what I want to do. And this was open for any prisoner who was interested. And this room was packed. Afterwards, man, as I was about to leave, you had, like, 30 prisoners. So I'm talking about like gangsters, bro. Like 6 foot whatever, tattoos on their face. You couldn't see skin, bro. Like, and just coming up to me like, hey, sir, I would really love to, you know, be part of this program. I'm like, bro, if you fart, you'd break my neck. And you're like begging me, like, and calling me sir. You know what I mean? Like, it was weird, dude. And then having to go through an application process of everyone's story, the time they're going to get out, on the time, the date they're going to get out, why they want to be part of the program, and like me having to choose and narrow down a certain amount of people for the class, because this is the first class. So having the second amount of authority of like it was such a responsibility, bro, picking and choosing people's lives. And then I couldn't do it. It was too hard for me. So I had to ask the prison officer who was helping me to kind of like narrow it down, and he chose the best ones he thought for the program. I've got 3 murderers in my class, and they hold scissors beside my head. Do I feel safe? Yeah. Was I scared? Yeah. But that's because of the stigma, bro. These dudes don't want to harm you, bro. I don't think, like, any more than anyone else, bro. They're just troubled people who just had a horrible experience. And whether they reoffended or not, like, at that moment, they're in prison. They're paying their dues for whatever crime they've committed. And I'm doing everything I can to give back to them the way my parents never gave up on me, on my mom especially. I don't want to give up on these guys. If society's going to give up on them, so be it. I will never give up on these guys, no matter how many times they reoffend. If they do something wrong by me, then they're going to be my angel, because I'm sure that whatever they would do to me will allow me to become closer to my creator, or try to learn from my lesson and try to become a better person. And that's why I'm saying they would be my angel. Just thinking about the guys that are in my class too and how much respect they have for me. Like, I just wish people hearing this knew that, like, these guys are just like hardcore criminals, man. And they're nicer than 90% of the people that I meet. They're more genuine and sincere than 95% of the people I meet. You know, I think they just need some love, bro. They're just troubled. And so, I mean, it's been pretty cool. You know, some of these guys have really learned how to cut hair. We have another program this Sunday. So we go every 2 Sundays. And the first thing was, it was about service. So I brought the team from the shop, Vince and Sarah. You know, Sarah rocks front of house. Vince is like basically my lieutenant beside me. I love them so much, bro. They're like my legs, bro. You know? And they came to the prison and we went through the program, what the Streets Barber program is all about. And that's about giving service and being of service. And that's what the motto of the shop's, you know, it's not about giving a service, so being of service. And that's what we're all about. And so as like a forefront of every barber in the class's mind, it needs to be about how can you make that person benefit from that experience? And then we learn how to cut hair. So that's the first thing that's going on through these guys' heads. It's not about, let me give these guys a cool fade, let me make a couple bucks for the haircut. Let me make sure that person's in my chair is actually going to leave happier. Is it going to work? Who knows? I'm just giving the benefit of the doubt, bro. Because what else do I have to give? I can't be like everyone else, bro. I'm not just going to put them down. I want to be different.
Is there any selection process you go through besides the applications because you chucked on them? Is there, you going to say no to anyone?
No. I'll say yes to anyone if they want to do
if they want to change.
And if they want to change and if they're showing incentive. Absolutely. No matter what your crime. Hate the sin, not the sinner, bro. Jesus said it perfect. So, I mean, that's just how it is. And that's the thing. I try not to know what they've done. I mean, if they want to open up and tell me, then I'm not going to say, cover my ears. Don't tell me. I mean, it's profound, bro. Like, the reason why I went to prison is because, like, a lot of the dudes that I'd be cutting on the streets were actually just coming out of jail. Or I wouldn't see them for a couple months in Footscray, and they'd come back, oh, I just did 6 months. You know what I mean? So I'm like, my mom used to always tell me, focus on the solution, not the problem, bro. She would actually call me bro. That's the fucking relationship I have. My mom was crazy. No, straight up. She calls me bro. My dad calls me bra. I love him so much. But it's true, man. Focus on the solution. And that my solution was like, all right, let's try to get these guys before they come out and are just put into a halfway house with a whole bunch of other junkies. You know what I mean? Being treated as a criminal and hated by everyone. What's the one thing they're going to probably start doing again? What they know and what allows them to escape. Do you reckon these guys are really happy when they come out? Maybe they're happy to not be in, but you think they're happy of the, like their life? No. So what did we talk about earlier on the podcast? Are any junkies really happy? No. Or anybody who wants to escape, whether it's through drugs or not, but any other vice that's not beneficial for them, truly happy? Hell no. If you're really happy, you never want to escape that mental state.
How much of who you are now do you reckon has been molded by your addiction and everything you've gone through? Do you ever sit back and think what you'd be doing if you didn't?
I'd be dead. No doubt. No doubt, bro. 100%. My parents even say that. Nah, it's like the route you were going, bro. You wouldn't be alive. You'd be either dead from drugs or from like a rival gang or from someone. You'd be in prison. Something wouldn't be right. So absolutely, that's where I'd be. And I would say like how much of everything has formed. Like I would like to think who I am is through experiences up to date. But I'm also not who I am yesterday, bro.
Yep.
You get me? So it's kind of like catch 22. I try to compare myself now to who I was today and how I can be better tomorrow.
Yep.
That's how I live my life now, bro. Who I am today, how can I be better tomorrow? That's the only time you can reflect and really compare yourself to anyone.
Do you think a person, someone can be truly altruistic?
Oh man, that's hard. I don't know.
You're pretty close by the way you talk now.
Nah, man. Oh, sorry. This is me being that extra humble again.
We don't let you do that.
Well, that's the thing. I wasn't even thinking of myself, man. Like, I mean, I'm sure. Yeah, of course, bro. Like, you can overcome adversity and just like bounce back and just be so like so different from the rest and just be on like a supernatural realm. I mean, there's so many people like that, bro. Like, absolutely.
Selfless concern.
Yeah, bro.
Everyone else.
Yeah, 100%. There are certain gifts, I mean, certain gifted people in this world, absolutely. But I think people like that specifically would be our mothers and fathers, without a doubt. Mostly probably our mothers. They're completely selfless for their kid. But as for the whole race of mankind, I mean, yeah, I'm sure there's been people in this world. Me? Hell no, bro. Like, I try to be like that. I strive to be like that. But man, I'm the dust on everyone's feet, bro. You know what I mean? Like, I'm no one better than anyone else, and I'm trying my best to leave a legacy where people feel motivated. You know what I mean? And this isn't me just being insecure and humble. Like, yo, I'm not worthy of anything. I think I'm worthy of a lot, man. I'm worthy of life, and I've been given life. But I'm not better than anyone. And that's why I can sit down with someone on the streets or in prison or at a shelter or in the hospital, and I can just vibe with them one-on-one.
It's not about being better than everyone else. So it's about a selfless concern. And you can't say that you're not giving a selfless concern to everyone else out there.
Okay, yeah, I'll take that. I'll take it. Yeah, I would like to think that that's what I'm aiming to do. So if I'm aiming to do that, and if you see that, that's a blessing. And I appreciate that because clearly seems to be working.
It is.
Thank you, bro. Appreciate that. Big time.
Change of pace quickly. What was the first tattoo you got?
Oh man.
Oh yeah, I wanted to talk about this.
I got a
So just to give everyone, there'll be a few photos. You've got tattoos everywhere.
Yeah.
It's on your doco, you've got tattoos.
Yeah.
You've spoken about the arms in the jail.
Yeah.
What was the first one you got?
So I lived in Vanuatu when I was 19. So that was another like escape from not going to rehab. So like it was like 10 different times I tried to like move away and start fresh, as everyone loves to do, you know, when they're going through hard times, but they're just escaping reality one way or another. My way was to go to Vanuatu and volunteer like my brothers did, but in the South Pacific. But I ended up just smoking weed with the boys there down after 10 months, and I got kicked back out of the country by the organization I was with, and I got sent home. So another failure that I did, by the way, which led me just to go back to my shame and everything. But one of the local boys there, he had this tattoo of this dolphin jumping into the sunset that he gave himself on his bicep with a sewing, with like just like a local machine that they would make, and it was like a tattoo for the boys in the area, like the island, and it's supposed to resemble peace. I don't know why, but I was like, "Yo, hook me up." And so, sure enough, I met this local dude from a village, and with a sewing needle and ink from a pen, he just jabbed me up on my ribs, and I gave him cigarettes in exchange. So,
yeah, really?
Yeah, it was dope. It's my favorite piece, man. It looks like a swordfish though, like jumping into, and it's like having a seizure. But it's dope, man. Yeah. So that's my favorite piece, bro. 100%.
Favorite and first?
Yeah, I was going to ask.
Favorite that. That's probably my, one of my favorites. My favorite would probably be on my forearm where I was shooting coke. Like, for some reason, the first needle that went into my vein, it left a slight scar. And so I put my mom's name over it. Nice. I would say that's my favorite. And every year that I'm sober, I put a line in my hand, so I'm up to 7 now. So like those are my also favorites too. And I guess my brother's eyelids are pretty cool. I mean, my eyelids of my brother's names, those are pretty badass too, I guess. I look at it now. It's funny, man. My brothers are so different to me. So when I show them my eyelids, they're like, I'm like, yo, boys, I got one. And they're like, you're an idiot. The irony, bro.
I was just going to say, you said, I look at them now. How do you look at them? Yeah.
True. No, I look at my bros. Face to face or FaceTime or whatever it is, you know, they're all around the world. So my middle brother's married with his wife and they have a 2-year-old daughter. So beautiful. My niece, Amaya, in North Carolina. My other brother, Nima, who's just like, they're both basically my lungs. Like I breathe for them. My oldest is in Germany right now with his fiance. They're about to get married in the Caribbean in October. So, it's pretty cool, man. International family, big time. And he's all about basketball too. Like, I'm not joking. Like, he just spent a few months in Senegal with NBA Africa. Like, he's getting pretty high up in the community, the NBA community, because he uses his skills and basketball love in when he was living here with the South Sudanese boys in Collingwood, and like teaching these boys how to, you know, play some serious ball. Now they're like potential NBA recruits.
Yeah, right.
So he's really giving back, man. So
awesome.
It's an impressive family.
I wish, bro. I wish.
Is, man.
Thank
Far
you, bro.
Right.
Thank you, bro.
I think there's going to be part 2 with this one.
Yeah.
King, down the track.
King.
Sure.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
let's just go to our ones we ask all the time, Reg.
Yeah.
Because we'll start winding this one up a little bit.
Yeah, easy, right?
And we'll go part 2. But do you want to start with the big one, Reg?
The big one. This is my favorite question. You can invite 3 people to dinner. Living or dead, who do you invite?
Oh, man.
Can be anyone.
And why?
So Abdul Baha, first and foremost, he is the son of the prophet for the Baha'i faith. And he, from the examples and the stories of who he was, he would be that person.
Yeah.
He would be that person you're talking about.
Truly altruistic.
Bro, he spent 40 years in prison. He's the one who said the greatest prison is the prison of self. He spent 40 years in prison for being a Baha'i. And upon his release, he actually asked the governor and his 2 sons to have lunch and spend the day with him so he can show them love and respect. The ones who put him in prison for 40 years. That's the kind of man he was. Absolutely lovely. So selfless, so giving. Such an inspiration of who to be and how to be. His name was Servant of Baha and Baha's Glory. And his father was Baha'u'llah. And that was the title. And the glory of God, I believe is the name, is the translation. So his name, literally, he just decided to call himself the servant of Baha, the servant of glory, because he just wanted to be a servant. He wanted to serve everyone. He would be first and foremost.
Good start.
Yeah, absolutely. Second person.
It's a tough one.
It is, bro.
Everyone's heard ours. We should. Do you want to change your third?
No, I'm just going to keep giving different suggestions every episode. I told you this.
I reckon actually another one would 100% be Bob Marley, bro.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Absolutely. Good one. Because he's just like, he was a prophet to those people, bro. You know what I mean? He was also quite like detached and removed.
Yep.
You know? That cool speech about, are you rich? And he goes, what does richness define? You know, and the guy's like, do you have money? He goes, money make you rich, you know, like true Rasta. Nah, me no rich then, you know, and it was just cool the way he said it.
Yep.
And I would say probably the third is Nelson Mandela as well. Like, yeah, that guy's the goat, bro. Like, you know, just straight up. And just because his voice was super cool too. I would just love to listen to him speak.
Yeah. Powerful selections.
Three very, very good ones. Can you describe the color yellow to someone that is blind?
Oh,
yeah, slightly. This is Hendo's big question.
Oh my God. Could I explain the color yellow to someone who is blind? No.
No?
No, because I was going to say, just think of like what you can see right now, which is nothing but a little bit brighter. But then I just realized, how would they see that?
we've had a couple of good ones. We had Mick actually said, when you walk outside and you feel the sun on you, that's yellow, that warmth of the sun.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. Mix boss though, man.
Yeah, we did a good one. What was Sally's?
She had a good one too. Did someone say like happiness? Because I think, Mick as well?
Oh, no, I reckon that was Sally. Happy color? Mick said strength. Yeah. He said the feeling of strength.
Yeah.
It's a strong color. What is an unusual habit or an absurd thing that you love?
Oh man, I love when people are just like direct and literal with me, bro. To the point where like everyone around me is just so like, yo, I said blah, 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 but.
That's not absurd at all to me, because that's all I love as well.
You're that.
No,
too.
I'll
just be straight out honest.
But it's not even straight out honest. It's like, if they're like, yo man, it's just like, I'll be there in 2 seconds. I'm like, you're not going to be there in 2 seconds. You're going to be there in 2 minutes. But it's simple things like that. Oh, I just said something quickly, but did it take quickly? How long is quickly?
When people say literally, when they mean figuratively.
Yes.
Oh, I was literally a million miles away.
But it's weird. No, it wasn't. Though. It's like borderline obsession though, like in my mind. Yeah. To the point where like, I've got to like take a step back, and this is where the mindfulness thing comes in. It's like, man, I can see myself getting heated because someone is just so casually saying something.
Yeah.
That, you know, it they don't think of it as something serious. I became so obsessed with it that I made a mountain out of a mole. Yeah. You get me? So that's like a serious thing for me. And I got to work on that. It's detachment, bro. I've got to be detached from meaningless words. You get me?
Yeah.
So,
there you go.
Literally. Yeah. Nice. Okay. One last question. What are your parents up to now?
Getting ready for my brother's wedding, really. My mom's a boss, bro. I'm telling you. Like now she's in Canada. She's a social worker. She basically is a government. She works for the government, but not as in like childcare taking people away. She tries to help out a family before they get split up by the government. So she tries to give them everything that she can and give them as many tools and coping mechanisms and help and therapy and all that stuff to keep the family together. So she has to come home. English isn't her first language. And she'd come home and write like extensive, like 3-4 page letter to the government explaining why she thinks or doesn't think the family suitable and if they can stay together. And so something like that could take an hour or two. It takes her about 6 hours. Mm. And she does it every night. And she was taking care of my grandma, who was basically on her last days for the last 5 years, you know, in a home. And she'd have to feed her because my grandma wouldn't be able to eat by herself. And so she would do that, deal with these like hectic families, man. And then just come home and just write the thing for like 5-6 hours. My grandma finally passed away. Rest her soul. And, you know, she's still doing what she's doing, but she's a warrior. And my dad just does the same thing, man. Still trying to serve the community wherever he's at. And so like every night he's almost doing something with the community. He's about 70 years old. My mom's about 64. So like, you know, they're just living life like they're still in their 20s, bro.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll call it.
Yeah, that is awesome. Yes. I think we might have to get his parents in for a podcast because yeah. I would love to.
Dude, Skype me while I'm in the Caribbean. We'll send a quick photo to all you guys.
Yeah, love it.
That'd be cool.
Mate, thank you for your time. Bless. I reckon there might be a part two down the track.
Yeah, there might
because I reckon there's a lot more to talk about than what we've just.
Yeah, we could talk about what happens like 6, maybe 12 months after my workshops. You know, and see what happens with that.
Yeah,
so.
That'd be great. Sure. Yeah,
no, cool. I'd love to talk about it. And I reckon you're the most altruistic person that I've met, mate. So.
Did you just learn that word because you're using it?
I'm just going to keep using it.
Did you just?
Hey, don't take away from a very sentimental moment that I'm trying to.
No, it's perfect, bro, because he took it away before I did, so it's all good.
Yeah, he's uncomfortable with this.
That's right, I'm uncomfortable. Yeah. I'm trying to say something bless. Nice.
Hey, bro, thank you. That's very, very sweet, man. And like, honest to God, as much as I want to appreciate the words that you're saying, I just don't see it in myself. And I aim to be like that. And so, you saying those words is a very beautiful and also motivational, inspirational thing for me to kind of keep on my mind because it's like it's something that you can see and I just want to continue with that. So am I doing it for that though? No. But if that's what's going to come from it, then bless, you know?
Thank you, mate.
Appreciate it.
Awesome chat.
Thank you, boys. Keep kicking goals, you know what I mean?
We'll do our best.
Thank Sweet. You so much, man.
Thank you.
There you go, guys. Thanks to Naz for sharing that. Really hope you enjoyed it. I know we did. Like we said, it was a pretty full-on story, but he's an incredible person. I'm sure we can all learn from. If you did enjoy it, please go and like and follow us on Instagram at the Elephant Rope Podcast and like and subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode.
Hey, Reginald.
Here we go.
What do you call an Irishman who's so hyperactive that he's literally bouncing off the walls?
What?
Rick O'Shea.
I've heard that's a soccer reference. I should have got it. Damn it.
I got it. I actually realize that goes for that long.
It goes forever.
I got one more.
Come on.
What's orange? It sounds like a parrot.
Carrot?
Yeah. Yes. Thanks, guys.